The world is supported by LegalZoom. We're halfway through the year, but it's never too late to get started on things you want to accomplish. LegalZoom can help you complete some of the things on your to-do list with their friends and family discount. For more information, visit LegalZoom.com.
From NASA scientist to political prisoner, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. NASA scientist Serkan Gölge went to Turkey to visit family. Then the government there accused him of supporting a coup.
And then all of a sudden, because of some crazy anonymous tip, you're in prison and you stay in prison for 3 years.
Now the dual citizen is out. We'll hear his story today on the show. Plus, on day two of his visit to the UK, President Trump gets Brits all riled up by suggesting their National Health Service should be part of a trade deal.
When you're dealing in trade, everything's on the table. So NHS or anything else.
Why Brits are saying not so fast. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A special relationship ever since Winston Churchill spoke those words in 1946. That's how the U.S. and the U.K. have described our transatlantic partnership. Today in London, President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Theresa May leaned in on the idea more than a few times.
The celebration of the special relationship.
This really is a very big and important alliance.
This precious and profound friendship.
There was great love. It was an alliance.
This most important relationship.
We have an incredible intelligence relationship.
This deep special relationship and partnership.
It's the greatest alliance the world has ever known.
I think we can say the relationship is special. The World's Orla Barry is based in London, where she's been reporting on the president's state visit there. Welcome back, Orla.
Thanks, Marco.
So in addition to the historic special relationship, May and Trump also discussed the future of UK-US relations. Explain how that's going to center a lot on Brexit.
Yes, it always seems to come back to Brexit at some point, doesn't it? Well, he was asked what he thought about Brexit and what the UK should do about Brexit. And of course, he told us, as you might have expected, that he always knew that Brexit was going to happen. He predicted it even before any of the rest of us did. Interestingly, he did praise Theresa May this time around for having done a great job on it and admitted that he had said we should sue the EU, but that Theresa May is probably a better negotiator than him and she hasn't done that yet. What he did say is that the US is committed to a phenomenal trade deal with the UK.
There is tremendous potential in that trade deal. I say probably two and even three times of what we're doing right now. Tremendous potential.
But actually part of that, Marco, I should say, has got people talking. He also said that what was on the table is the NHS, the National Health Service here in the UK.
Right. There was a question in the press conference related to this that I want us to hear.
Do you agree with your ambassador that the entire economy needs to be on the table in a future trade deal, including the NHS?
Right, the National Health Service. So here was Trump's answer.
Look, I think everything with the trade deal is on the table. When you're dealing in trade, everything's on the table. So NHS or anything else, or a lot more than that. But everything will be on the table, absolutely.
So, Orla, explain the background of how the sacred National Health Service for many Brits relates to trade and why this has really riled up Brits.
This really had people exercised this afternoon. It is very much a British institution. For most of us living here, it means that we do have free healthcare, free prescriptions, free doctor visits, etc. Although it's not as amazing as people might think. There are long, long waiting lists involved in all of that. But for most people living in the UK, it's always been really important to have an NHS that's available to them. By saying that he was going to put the NHS on the table, essentially he's saying he's opening up the system to American health companies and to US pharmaceuticals to become providers of NHS services and thus privatising the NHS and making it a system that might be more familiar to Americans. Mm. And there's been a huge backlash against this today. The series of contenders for the Tory leadership have been out this afternoon tweeting about it, saying, you know, not in my watch, this ain't going to happen. Should be said, Marco, Prime Minister Theresa May, she came in very, very quickly to respond on this.
The point about making trade deals is, of course, that both sides negotiate and come to an agreement about what should or should not be in that trade deal.
Yeah, sounds like she was saying not so fast.
Yeah, exactly, not so fast. Also, I should say, because I was in Trafalgar Square this morning where a lot of people gathered to protest against Trump's visit. Many of them that I spoke to complained about this idea of America taking control, or Donald Trump and his administration taking control in some way of the NHS.
So for these public protests, I mean, there were some loud voices out there. What were some of the main themes you saw on the streets?
Lots of themes ranging from misogyny to racism to climate change. A lot of people mentioned the NHS. There was people there from Nicaragua talking about how Donald Trump and his administration have treated their country. There was people there from Venezuela, from Ecuador, and a lot of angry voices. The president, by the way, was asked about the protest during the press conference this afternoon, and he dismissed it and said, actually, there was people out there waving British and American flags in support of him.
It was tremendous spirit and love. There was great love. It was an alliance. And I didn't see the protesters until just a little while ago, and it was a very, very small group of people put in for political reasons. So it was fake news. Thank you.
How many people were there protesting?
There were thousands there. Not as many as last time round. They did talk about up to 250,000 last year. And there wasn't that kind of number today, but we are talking about tens of thousands on the streets of London today.
Yeah, that was real, and apparently so was the rain.
It was very real. I felt it. I felt it.
The World's Orla Barry, reporting from London. Thank you, as always.
Thanks, Marco.
Recently, President Trump was speaking with another world leader he admires, Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The subject of their call was Serkan Gölge, an American and Turkish citizen who was detained in Turkey for almost 3 years. He was released just this last week on probation, but he can't leave Turkey. Gölge was a NASA scientist when he took a trip to Turkey to visit his family in 2016. He was there more than a week after July 15th that year. That night, some members of the military attempted a coup against Erdogan. Pandemonium erupted on the streets of Istanbul and Ankara. That night, hundreds of people died. In the following months, more than 100,000 people would be arrested under suspicion of conspiring against the government, researchers, journalists, academics, scientists. At the time of his visit that summer, Serkan Gölge didn't think much of the arrests. He figured they had nothing to do with him.
We were kind of just making a joke about it just a few days earlier because of this arrests. I said, you know, I mean, I got nothing to do with that, but, you know, would it be possible that someone crazy calls the police and says something about me? And it happened. That's all it started. I was stopped by the police saying that there is an anonymous tip about me, that I am a member of a terrorist organization, and I also work for the CIA. The police claimed that they found a dollar bill, a single dollar bill in the home in my little brother's closet, which I never stayed in. They said this one single dollar bill was associated with terrorism.
Right. And that terrorist organization that you're referring to, headed up by Fethullah Gulen, the cleric in exile in Pennsylvania, who's suspected of being behind the failed 2016 coup in Turkey. So were you working with Fethullah Gulen?
No, absolutely not. But later on, we found out who was the anonymous tip. It was one of my relatives, and he was angry with everything. And
What was your relative angry about?
About what happened in Turkey on 15th of July.
Why would they point the finger at you, though?
He was angry. was angry at the United States. He knew that I go back and forward to the United States. I guess he just felt it was the right thing to do.
What was that like for you, knowing that somebody in your family was basically turning you in?
It, you know, whether it was family or not, even if it was my friend, one of my friends, that was something very ridiculous, you know. I mean, it hurt me a lot. Because if that thing didn't happen, I wouldn't have lost my job. I wouldn't have lost my house, you know, things like that.
So you've lost your job with NASA and your home back in the States, in Houston?
That's correct. Because, you know, I think it, maybe you know, but it's been about 3 years. Because I lost my job, I never had an income. And my wife couldn't work. So my only income basically was the money coming from my dad.
I understand, though, that the terms of your release, you won't be able to leave Turkey. Why not?
It will take about 8-9 months. There is one police car waiting in front of my house. I can't leave my house. I can't go anywhere without them escorting me. Basically, that's where I am. I have to continue to sign that document, this control.
That's part of your probation. I mean, do you have to, like, present yourself in person on a regular basis to sign a document? Is that the deal?
Exactly. 4 days a week.
4 days a week you have to sign a document.
That is correct. Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday.
What happens if you don't sign them?
They will just return me back to the prison. That's what happens. I didn't have any restriction before, but unfortunately, I learned just a few days ago, I am restricted to only travel in the Hatay city limits because I believe President Trump, it was a few days ago, maybe he heard about it. He said he's very happy that I'm released and I will be returning back to the United States soon.
To the United States pretty soon. And I just want to thank President Erdogan. We dealt with that. And he was great. They released this prisoner.
I don't know what he meant with that, but I'm guessing he doesn't know the terms of my condition.
So since Trump's comments at that press conference, your restrictions have gotten tighter. Would you have preferred that Trump not say anything about your case?
I think what happened was the Department of Justice was a little bit oversensitive about what he said, because it's been 6 days since my release. I never missed anything, and I don't plan to miss my signatures. I mean, they should have looked at me, not somebody else's words. So I think it's a bit, they became a little bit oversensitive about what President Trump said.
Yeah, and considering how sensitive the Turkish Department of Justice is about your case, how nervous are you right now as we speak about what you're telling us?
I am a little bit nervous because, you know, I would have preferred less restriction because I think I served enough.
I'm speaking with Serkan Gölge, a former NASA scientist who was arrested in the massive roundup of suspects in the aftermath of the attempted coup in Turkey in 2016. Serkan, how did being in detention in Turkey for 3 years affect you?
Well, first of all, as I said, it was a shock for me, for my family. The first detention, the first arrest, I never expected anything like that. I can't describe it with words, but I was in like a coma. I couldn't sleep or I couldn't eat for days. I had to stay in an isolated cell. I mean, think about it. You're a NASA scientist. You're doing something valuable. And then all of a sudden, because of some crazy anonymous tip and some simple, stupid dollar bill, you're in prison and you stay in prison for 3 years. You know, that's pretty harsh.
What's been the effect on your family? What's been the long-term effect on them over 3 years?
It's been pretty bad. It's been pretty bad. I mean, psychologically, and it's been very bad. You know, it will take some time to recover this trauma because we were hit both financially and also psychologically. It's going to take a lot of time to recover all of this. I mean, I cannot even describe. I don't want this to happen anyone really. I mean, and it's going to take a lot of time to recover from all of this.
It sounds like there was a really deep effect on you and your family from all of this detention in the last 3 years. Are you going to do anything legally about this?
Oh, absolutely. I will follow any legal rights I have. I always objected to the decision from the day one or day zero. I objected to the decision. I have always objected to the decision, but the only thing you can do is take it to higher courts, appeals court and the constitutional court and the European Courts of Human Rights. I believe it will turn out positively for me.
Serkan Gölge is a former NASA scientist who was arrested in Turkey in 2016 in the massive roundup of suspects in the wake of the attempted coup there. Serkan, thanks very much for telling us your story and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Later this hour on the show, how the history of Tiananmen Square shapes one Hong Kong native sense of identity. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For many Muslims around the globe, tonight is the end of Ramadan, the Islamic holy month, and the sighting of a new moon marks the start of Eid celebrations. But in Khartoum, Sudan, the celebrations are wrought with confusion right now. That's after violence there yesterday. At least 30 unarmed protesters were shot and killed by security forces in an ongoing struggle to fill Sudan's power vacuum. Today, the internet was effectively shut down there, which limits how protesters and others can communicate. We reached reporter Jason Patankin in Khartoum and asked him about the violence.
Yesterday, which is when all the violence happened, no foreign journalists were allowed out of their hotels, so we were cooped up inside. So this morning we ventured out, and basically the streets were mostly deserted where we drove, and there's a large presence of the Rapid Support Forces, which is a Darfuri militia accused of many atrocities, including the violence of yesterday to break up the sit-in. We drove through one neighborhood called Buri, and Buri has been sort of the epicenter of the revolution from December until April, when there was all sorts of street protests. Most of that was in Buri, so they're very much like hardcore revolutionaries there. Every street in Buri is blocked. There are roadblocks everywhere. These are just the regular people have set up piles of rocks, trees, logs, burning tires, just everywhere. I mean, to go from A to B is a very difficult maze.
Well, you mentioned the attack by the security forces undertaken by this group known as the Rapid Support Forces. They've been loyal to the now deposed President Omar al-Bashir. Who are these forces exactly, and are they simply an extension of the ex-president? And how directly do they take orders from the current military regime?
They have their roots in the Janjaweed, which many listeners have probably heard of. They're the notorious militia that allegedly committed genocide in Darfur in around 2003, 2004. And so basically, the Janjaweed were reorganized into various militias, and the most prominent of those is now called the Rapid Support Forces. And they're led by a commander, his name is Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo, but his nickname is Hemeti. Everyone calls him Hemeti. Hemeti was basically Omar al-Bashir's pick to receive all sorts of money, all sorts of equipment, weapons, et cetera, to do the regime's dirty work. And Hemeti was very glad to do this. He became extremely powerful, and the Rapid Support Forces take their orders from him. What seems to be clear is that Burhan and Hemeti are working together, and that the RSF is the most powerful arms group in Khartoum, and that's not an easy situation for the protesters to change.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a real dilemma for the demonstrators. Have you heard anything about how they're moving forward, what they're planning next?
So, yeah, that's something we asked a lot of people. And the general answer is civil disobedience, which is quite vague. But again, it means, barricading roads, work stoppages, basically trying to bring the country to a halt and trying to show the military that they are not accepted as legitimate by the people. But nobody that I can tell is who, or at least who I've talked to, has said they're giving up. But I should say that most of the people I talked to were people who were wounded or who are in Buri. So these are really the hardcore of the revolution. I think a question will be whether the more, I don't want to say moderate, but whether the people who have supported the revolution but haven't necessarily been on the barricades and haven't necessarily slept at the sit-in for 1 or 2 months straight. I think the question is whether those people who have been very supportive of the revolution will continue to support it despite the events of the last couple of days.
Journalist Jason Patankin in Khartoum, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Here's something painful to contemplate. What if a loved one was murdered or went missing and you never found out what really happened? For indigenous communities in Canada, this is a shockingly common occurrence, and the victims are overwhelmingly women. This week, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau released a report from a 3-year national inquiry into the matter. It concludes that Canada is complicit in, quote, race-based genocide against indigenous women, and that indigenous women are 12 times more likely to be killed or go missing than other women in Canada. Hilda Anderson-Pierce works with families of missing or murdered relatives from northern Manitoba First Nations communities. She and her family took part in the hearings held by the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls because of a deeply personal connection to the story. In November 2011, her sister Dawn was found dead outside her home in northern Manitoba. Hilda and her family believe her death was never properly investigated. Hilda, thanks very much for being with us. I know it's been a few years since Dawn passed, but my condolences to you and your family all the same. What can you share with us about your sister? What do you want us to know about her?
That she was an amazing person, and she was an awesome mother, and she has three daughters who now have to grow up without their mother.
How do you think your sister's story fits into the larger story, the story of approximately 1,200 Aboriginal women and girls who disappeared and perished?
I would say, you know, that her story is very common when it comes to Indigenous women and girls and Indigenous families accessing justice. They're not given the same quality or quantity of services and treatment as to somebody who would be non-Indigenous, who had the exact same lived experience as an Indigenous woman or girl. The level of investigation that was conducted was very minimal, and I felt that not only do I feel that, many other families across the country feel that in many circumstances they're treated like their loved one didn't matter, that she was not an important part of their lives, that she was not a part of their family.
The report that came out says Canada is complicit in a genocide against Indigenous women and girls. What does that statement mean to you, a genocide against Indigenous women and girls?
It means that it took report for Canada to recognize that there is a genocide against Indigenous women and girls because of the racism that exists, the way that society perpetuates violence against Indigenous women and girls. We don't feel safe in our own country, and it's really important for key decision makers such as the Canadian government and institutions who provide those resources and supports, or the lack of, to Indigenous women and girls to recognize that and to come to the table and allow Indigenous women and girls to lead the very critical changes that are required to make Canada safe for Indigenous women and girls.
So, Hilda, I just want you to make it clear to our audience that what this inquiry is really about is not kind of blaming Canada for the deaths, but it's really about neglect for these communities. Am I getting that right?
I would say, yeah, neglect is a correct terminology to use, but also more so that making Canada aware that as Canadians, as the state, that we all have a responsibility to end violence against Indigenous women and girls. And these are truths that have been shared by families and survivors who've been deeply impacted by the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. So we cannot turn a blind eye to that. I have a lot of hope with respect to this report because it's the first time in Canadian history that a national inquiry has occurred with all provinces and territories signing on and being part of the national inquiry. So that in itself is different from any other type that has occurred in Canada. And it also holds different provinces and territories and the federal, provincial, municipal, and First Nations government accountable to ensure that the calls for justice are implemented.
Hilda Anderson-Pierce works with families of missing or murdered relatives from northern Manitoba First Nations communities. Hilda, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Vladimir Putin's power inspires loyalty among many young Russians, but so does opposition leader Alexei Navalny when he speaks out against authoritarian rule.
I would like to see other people, but for now it's great that we have at least one person who does that much.
Young Russians talk politics. That's just ahead here on The World. This week, we're reporting a series of stories about Russia, specifically Russian youth. Today, our focus is on politics, so we're talking basically two groups of young people. The first, those who actively support President Vladimir Putin.
Who do the streets belong to in Russia?
Too easy question. Улица принадлежит нам.
All right, I don't speak Russian, so let me bring in the world's Daniel Hoffman here.
Hey, Marco.
Hey, Daniel. Daniel and I traveled to Russia together to report these stories.
So the person you heard there, his name is Sergei Khristienko. He said the streets belong to us, and by us he means Putin's party, United Russia.
And then there's the opposition, who are the young Russians challenging Putin and his party, and who also claim to hold the streets.
Right. This second group includes supporters of a different party called Russia of the Future. It's led by Alexei Navalny.
Navalny is the most prominent of the Russian opposition voices.
Yeah, and he first became known as a result of a blog he ran on government corruption. But he really arrived on the scene in the lead-up to the 2012 presidential elections in Russia.
Alexei Navalny!
Moscow saw some of its biggest protests since the end of the Cold War. And there in the middle of it all was Alexei Navalny.
Привет, бандерлогам и сетевых хомячков!
Навальный wasn't actually a presidential candidate at the time, but he was everywhere. He had this fiery tone that still rings true for many Russians who are fed up with the status quo. These days, Навальный brings that tone to other platforms, primarily YouTube.
Потому что вы своим видом, своей глупостью, своей некомпетентностью позорите Россию.
He's anti-Putin all the way. And he and his supporters have paid the price for that.
To get to the nerve center of Alexei Navalny's party and PR operation, we took the metro several stops outside the center ring of the city. It's in a part of Moscow where you see Soviet-era buildings getting squeezed out by shopping centers and modern office blocks. The Russia of the Future Party headquarters is based in one of these modern buildings.
Marko.
Очень приятно.
Lyubov Sobol is Navalny's longest-serving aide. Today, she's the producer of the Navalny Live YouTube channel.
Мы сейчас находимся в студии канала Навальный Live. Здесь, в том числе, за стенкой располагается студия небольшая.
Right now, we're in the Navalny Live studio. In the next room, there's another small studio where Navalny records his videos for his main channel. He has 2.5 million subscribers on Russian YouTube.
The Navalny Live YouTube channel is one of the main ways the Russia of the Future Party gets its message out. That message shrewdly is embedded in the channel's investigative reporting into corruption high up in the Russian government.
We're not doing this because we want to be producers or YouTubers. We're doing this because mass media does not allow people like Navalny, people who disagree with the government, to appear on state television. The media is controlled by the government, and that includes print media as well. You only see free expression on the internet.
And Daniel, it was somewhere around here in the interview that Sobol cited an old Russian proverb that she said explains the current state of the Russian government. What did she say?
She said the fish rots from the head, like meaning society rots from the top to the bottom. So real change would require a grassroots effort, starting from the bottom and going all the way up to the top.
Now, one of the problems these young activists have is another group of young activists who support Vladimir Putin with as much vigor.
Remember, this is a battle for the hearts and minds of young Russians. Alexei Navalny has tapped into something, something exciting, young and hopeful, something that united Russia is missing. So a push has been underway for a few years now to counter that, to solidify young support for Putin. Молодая Гвардия is essentially the youth wing of the United Russia Party. They've got a strong organization in Russia's second biggest city, St. Petersburg. So that's where we went to meet them.
Inside the main hall of the St. Petersburg train station, the statue of Peter the Great greeted us as we arrived. And outside on Nevsky Prospect, we ran across a giant parade of at least 1,000 motorcyclists, including some of Putin's motorcycle gang loyalists, the Night Wolves. At the Molodaya Gvardiya headquarters, we waited in a conference room for the young Putin supporters. One of the walls was covered with an elaborately detailed events calendar.
Wow, it's really well scheduled here. Super strategic.
A few minutes later, 7 activists from Molodaya Gvardiya enter. Alexander. They're all in their 20s and pretty friendly.
Anna.
Sergei.
Michael.
Alexander.
Alexander Malikov is a Molodaya Gvardiya director in St. Petersburg. And Sergei Kristenko is his deputy. We asked both of them how they first got interested in politics. Here's Sergei.
Ну на самом деле я еще с первого класса хотел стать президентом. Вот.
To be honest, since first grade, I've wanted to become the president. Then, after ninth grade, I got into college, and from there, I got into Молодая Гвардия and United Russia.
And Alexander?
I think this actually might be a theme for many of us. In fact, my first essay in school was not if I become the president, but rather when I become the president, I will do these things A, B, C, D, E.
So clearly some of these activists have, or had anyway, some political ambitions. But for others, like Anastasia Koveza, they got involved with the group almost accidentally.
So for me, Молодая Гвардия is a social boost. It's not just for politicians and lawyers. So for me, I was a medical student and I was curious about how legislation is written. And thanks to my work within Молодая Гвардия, in just 3 years, not only did I get an internship, but I got the job.
What Anastasia says there is crucial. That social boost she talks about is a huge incentive for people to join Молодая Гвардия. Often people from all over Russia move to big cities like Moscow or St. Petersburg to pursue their education or to find better jobs. Once they get there, it's not easy to build connections and get ahead. That's one of the benefits Молодая Гвардия has to offer. All you have to do is support Putin and the United Russia Party. In other words, attend rallies, organize events, pump up pro-government statements on social media. If you do, they will help you get internships and jobs in the field of your choice.
I mean, what you're saying, Daniel, is that Молодая Гвардия is a political organization, but it's also kind of a social club. When we press them on more fundamental political issues, though, it feels like they are resorting to a script with talking points. Do you think of Russia as a democratic country?
Безусловно, считаем.
Without a doubt, we have a lot of political parties. I recall that in your country, there are two main political parties, Republicans and the Democrats. We have many more in our parliament and in our legislative assembly. In addition, we have many other public organizations where people voice their opinions.
That was Alexander. He's prepared to answer all of our questions. He's a pro. When I asked the group about the crackdown on NGOs in Russia, again, Alexander replies.
Я думаю, что средства массовой информации немного иначе преподносят вам эту информацию. Давайте я вам задам встречный вопрос. У вас
I would say that your media presents this question a little incorrectly. Let me ask you a question. In the US, are non-commercial organizations allowed to receive foreign funding and not declare these donations? As far as I'm aware, it's not allowed. Additionally, even citizens in some cases need to declare themselves as foreign agents, right? If you put aside what you're being told in the media over there, and if you just compare the laws of US and Russia, you will see that our law is much more liberal.
So Alexander deflects a criticism of Russia onto the United States. And Daniel, you noticed a change in the room when the discussion got more serious, didn't you?
Right. You could really feel the hierarchy amongst the group. Sergei would refer to Alexander in terms like my senior colleague. And about halfway through our meeting, Alexander basically took over the conversation. The younger Молодая Гвардия supporters sort of clammed up, almost instinctively.
Right. That's what happened when we asked him about the opposition, about Navalny, his popularity, and his ability to get people out in the streets to protest. The younger ones ceded the floor.
These Молодая Гвардия activists are proud. They're not going to be shown up by Navalny and the opposition. Now, they may not have as many subscribers as Navalny on YouTube, but they have full access to state-controlled media. The audience is older, but it's a huge audience, one that Navalny simply can't access. And like I said, the time and effort Молодая Гвардия put into organizing events later pays off with jobs and opportunities, even if they don't stay in politics. And again, the bargain is that they have to support United Russia and Putin, a contract that other political activists in Russia refuse to sign on to.
Right. I mean, that was certainly the case with the opposition activists we met in Nizhny Novgorod. It's a city about 300 miles east of Moscow. Less hustle and bustle, much calmer atmosphere. If the Navalny media operation in Moscow was slick, the Navalny supporters we met in Nizhny Novgorod kind of felt like the movement in its early days.
Marco.
Hello.
The Navalny headquarters here in Nizhny are really just a couple of rooms. Institutional desks and chairs, tables with future Russia pamphlets, and on the walls, framed photos of Alexei Navalny. Dmitry Silivonchik greets us. He's the local coordinator. And he introduces us to five other diehard Navalny supporters. These are people who go into the streets. They attend rallies, campaign during elections, and get arrested. Here's Dmitry Silivanchik.
Amongst the people present in this room, almost everyone here has been arrested at one point or another. So for the most part, any person who is actively involved in activism faces some sort of government investigation, persecution, fines, or short jail terms.
Those arrests, that rising pressure on the opposition to not protest, it really brings into sharp relief for these Navalny supporters what's at stake.
When I go to a rally or some activity, I'm afraid because I understand that I may not, come home.
That's another Dmitry Kalentiev. He's a tutor in Nizhny Novgorod, but in his free time, he's a future Russia activist, despite his fear. Putin's United Russia Party often depicts Navalny supporters, especially the younger ones, as clueless kids riled up by their angry leader. United Russia says that Navalny manipulates his people, that he's the one who's getting them arrested. But the Navalny supporters we met in Nizhny seem to know exactly what they're getting into and why. Here's Dmitry Silivanchik again.
If we don't do this work, then we will lose our future. This motivates me. I understand that if nothing changes, there won't be a future either way. We already basically lost everything, so we're trying to save the situation. That's how I see it.
Alexei Navalny, for me, it is like future. He gives me future.
This is Dmitry Kalentiev again.
He is just that person that wants to change the present. I think that there is no other person for now who does the same.
So, Daniel, what did you take away from meeting all of these young activists?
For these opposition activists, Alexei Navalny represents change, or the promise of change, especially the promise of ending corruption in politics. But even more than that, they like that Navalny is angry. He's channeling their anger. And I think that motivates the Navalny supporters to risk so much to do their work.
And thinking about just how different the dynamic was with the Putin supporters we met in St. Petersburg compared to the Navalny supporters in Nizhny Novgorod, the Navalny supporters have everything to lose, while the Putin supporters really have everything to gain. Leaving two questions out there for all of them. What price are you willing to pay to get ahead? And what price are you willing to pay for freedom?
Yeah, and these are the same questions that Navalny Live producer Lyubov Sobol is asking back at the Future Russia headquarters in Moscow. It may seem like Lyubov and her colleagues are a little bit safer than the activists in Nizhny Novgorod, but that's not necessarily the case.
Right. I mean, Lyubov told us that just 3 years ago, her husband, Sergei, was stabbed in the thigh with a syringe, which rendered him unconscious. I mean, he was hospitalized and eventually recovered, but Lyubov got the message.
In a way, we saw it ourselves. Aside from this threat of violence, Lyubov and many of the other Navalny activists are literally being watched.
Right. I mean, it was kind of stunning. Just as we were leaving Navalny headquarters, one of the activists pointed out to us that there are always these guys, spies really, watching who enters and exits their offices. Putin guys. So as we left the Navalny offices, we saw one of these people, and we decided to confront them.
Can I ask you a couple of questions?
I don't speak
no,
English.
No comments.
Do you speak English?
No.
After that encounter, the guy literally ran away, back into the elevator, probably trying to get out of the building. Unfortunately for him, though, the elevator was going up.
Right.
So on his way back down, the elevator stopped again, and the doors opened right in front of us. He was already on the phone saying, "Они меня снимают." They're recording me.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't feel sinister or dangerous, but it was a great reminder that if you're part of the opposition to Vladimir Putin, you'll be watched, maybe even more.
And that discourages a lot of young Russians from being politically active, from fully participating in the free exchange of ideas. And for those who do participate, sometimes they feel like they're shouting into the void.
Shouting into the void. We'll pick up on that when we meet young feminists in Russia, how they get their message out. Plus, Moscow rappers battle for their right to be the voice of their generation. Those stories coming up in the days ahead as our series from Russia continues. Today, on the 30th anniversary of the bloody crackdown at Tiananmen Square, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo put out an unusually blunt statement. He called the demonstrators brave heroes and demanded that the Chinese government account for the people who were killed or went missing back in 1989. China's reaction to Pompeo was equally sharp. Quote, "These lunatic ravings and babblings are destined for the garbage heap of history." One place in China where people do mark the Tiananmen Square anniversary is Hong Kong. Writer Louisa Lim was at the annual vigil today in Victoria Park.
The entire park was absolutely packed with people holding candles, singing songs. Every year there's a debate about how many people turn out, and there was a thought that this year more people would turn out than last year because of the debate over a very unpopular law the government's trying to pass about extradition and extradition treaty.
Briefly, just give me the contours of that extradition law. What is it saying?
Well, the extradition law says that anyone China says committed a crime can be extradited. And of course, Hong Kong people are really upset about that because we would be handing people over to a completely different legal system and it rises to all kinds of abuses of the law. And so this really opens up a whole can of worms. You know, businessmen, people passing through Hong Kong as well could be targeted. And foreign embassies, the chambers of commerce, they say it's the end of the idea of one country, two systems, that it would effectively be one country, one system.
Louisa, I saw on Twitter some photos you took of a statue known as the Goddess of Democracy in Hong Kong's Victoria Park. Looks kind of like a smallish Statue of Liberty. What does that statue represent?
So that is a replica of the Goddess of Democracy statue that students raised in Tiananmen Square in 1989. And every year in Hong Kong, they have this statue at the vigil. And it's one of the sort of markers. And there are certain universities in Hong Kong which also have replicas of that statue. And it's become a sort of gathering place.
Yeah, so Hong Kong is part of China, of course, but it's far from Beijing, where the Tiananmen massacre happened. How are these two places connected when it comes to the events of June 4th?
Well, in 1989, 1 million Hong Kong people marched against what was happening in Beijing. So it was the biggest protest Hong Kong has ever seen. And Hong Kong people felt very strongly about what had happened. And I think that was also a really important moment. And of course, now when people in China cannot remember publicly, people in Hong Kong still are able to remember and will not forget.
Journalist and writer Louisa Lim speaking with us from Hong Kong on this 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre. Louisa, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Hong Kong is also the home city of Francis Hoa.
I'm from a city owned by a country that I don't belong to.
Hoa is a college student in Boston now. She was born in Hong Kong after the UK returned it to Chinese rule in 1997. Like many people from Hong Kong, Hoa is proud of its independent spirit and democratic tradition, but that's not a view shared by everyone, something she found out on a bus ride in Boston.
An Asian man sat next to me on the bus and he was like, "Are you Chinese?" And then I say, "I come from Hong Kong." And then he was like, "Oh, Hong Kong is part of China, then you're Chinese." And then I was like, "No, I just basically, I come from Hong Kong, and that's it." He kept being, you know, more and more aggressive.
That inspired her to write an essay for her college newspaper about her pride and identity as a Hong Konger, and more critics piled on.
2 days after it was published, someone just like tagged me on Instagram and saying, "Oh, shame on you." I mean, being a columnist, I kind of like expect to get hateful comments. So I was like ignoring it. But it was like 3 a.m. that I was like studying and someone shared my post. And then I click on it and then I saw hateful comments basically saying that, "Oh, your parents should be ashamed of you. And whoever opposed China, no matter how far they are, they must be executed." And the word "executed" was written in red. You know, I put that out for everyone to see it, but at the same time, I don't feel comfortable anymore. I sang the Chinese national anthem when I was little, because I have to learn that. And I was proud seeing Chinese athletes winning in the Beijing Olympic Games. But then I learned about the Tiananmen Square massacre when I was 10, I would say. And I watched documentaries and news pictures of it.
A huge volley of shots just as I left the front line caused panic. The young man in front of me fell dead. I fell over him. Two others were killed yards away.
And it was horrifying for me as a kid. After seeing that massacre and all those, you know, things happening to those people who voiced their opinion, I realized, oh, there is such a big difference between China today and Hong Kong. Actually, the first protest or rally that I went is the Tiananmen Square Massacre Memorial in Hong Kong. And so my parents bring me there. Like, that was the moment that I started to pay more attention to Hong Kong politics and Chinese politics. I was maybe like 15 years old. I start being a student activist in Hong Kong. And yes, I got pepper sprayed. It was the Umbrella Revolution, right? And there were a lot of, you know, police confrontation with the protesters. And I was one of them. Every time when there are confrontations, journalists are always the people who go to the front and start taking pictures and, you know, asking questions. And I was like, this is such an amazing job to expose the truth to the public. So I start going into journalism, and I decided I want to study it. I want to be a journalist in Hong Kong. I want to tell the public about what happened in Hong Kong. And here I am in America learning English. And so the reason why I wrote that article is to bring awareness to that identity crisis among, you know, Hong Kongers, Taiwanese and Tibetan, or all those people that find difficulties identifying themselves. And the purpose of me writing this article was not only just to bring up awareness on this issue, but also tell people that we have to respect each and everyone's perspective and start having conversation about it even though we have differences.
Hong Kong native Frances Hui is a student at Emerson College here in Boston. Read her essay on Chinese identity and the Tiananmen anniversary at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.